You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Marina Ottaway, the director of the Middle East program here in Washington. And it's my great pleasure today to welcome here Michael Corbin, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, who is specifically in charge of the Iraq file at the State Department. Mr. Corbin has a long career as a diplomat in the Middle East. You have the bio. I will not go through it blow by blow. I just point out that between 1985 and now, Mr. Corbin has served in the Middle East or in the State Department working on the Middle East for all except the 97 to 2001 period. So he's very definitely an old hand, and in recent years he has worked extremely intensely on the on Iraq. I don't think we could have a better person to talk to us about what is happening in Iraq now and the different issues that arise, both in terms of the transition from military to civilian control and the developments in Iraq itself. So without further ado, since the time is limited, I will, although it's less limited than we thought, Mr. Corbin has agreed to stay until 1:15 if there is interest, so we have a little more time for discussion. But without taking any more of the little time we have, Mr. Corbin.
Thank you very much. It really is an honor to be here and to see friends and to see the interest in a subject that I'm extremely passionate about at the State Department for many reasons. And I will get into a description of where we see Iraq and the importance of Iraq. But I do want to leave lots of time for question and answers and discussion because I'm here to shed some light on a subject that in some circles in Washington, people suggest is over. The Iraq story is over. Very much the contrary. And what I'd like to set the stage for today is at the State Department, why Iraq is definitely not over. And I'll just I'll speak for hopefully just 10 to 15 minutes to then open for a conversation. I hope some of the things I say will lead to a lot of questions. First of all, at the State Department, as Dr. Ottaway said very kindly, I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I've worked in a lot of different types of missions. I've never worked in something where that has such important consequences for many levels of the State Department's world activities. This is about our relationship with the U.S. military. It's about our relations with regions. It's about our support for different segments of society. It's about how we take over in a post-conflict situation from the U.S. military. And we haven't done this to this extent since the Marshall Plan after World War II. So for me as a State Department, a career Foreign Service officer, every day I face the challenge of succeeding in maintaining a relationship in Iraq where the U.S. military is withdrawing and is withdrawing rapidly, and where the State Department and other civilian agencies need to take over and build a partnership that meets the needs of Iraq, that meets the needs of the region, and establishes the State Department as a force that can do this in other countries and other places around the world. I think this has enormous implications for what we do. Whether we succeed or the problems we face in Iraq may have nothing to do with Afghanistan, but it does have something to say how the State Department deals with the military, how we deal with the operational aspects of supporting Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, whatever potential situations you have in the future where the State Department and the civilian agencies need to step in a post-conflict situation. Let me just quickly say that the U.S. military is leaving. The State Department is taking over. We have a unique and enormous presence that we're building in Iraq of two consulates and two diplomatic offices, which are called embassy branch offices. We have the framework agreement set for a large bilateral partnership. It's called the Strategic Framework Agreement, which went into effect at the same time as a security agreement, which sets the conditions for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. We're working to build this partnership and to change it from a relationship that was 90% security and 10% everything else to perhaps the reverse, 10% security and 90% everything else. And that everything else is the partnership with the Iraqi people, with the government, and with the institutions. It's a partnership that focuses on education, agriculture, all the aspects of economy. It's protecting institutions, rule of law. It's building those partnerships that we see the Iraqis are seeking at this time. And this is complex, given the history over the last almost 8 years of the turmoil that has gone on in Iraq, and then the preceding period under Saddam Hussein and the various conflicts and issues that existed before then. So I leave to the question and answer period any details on the military to civilian transition, which is something that I spend at least half my day every day working on. And I'll turn to what makes this possible. And what makes this possible is the partnership that we're able to have with Iraqis who are making the difference. And this is where we believe we have the greatest potential for success. We went through a period of more than 7 months waiting for a government to be formed. But the government that was formed, it goes back to the model that we believed would be the best model for Iraq, if the Iraqis would agree to get to that model of government. This was an inclusive government where no one was excluded from the tent, where no one could return to insurgency, where no one would spend all their effort trying to undermine the system. This was a government where the two largest coalitions, Iraqiya and State of Law, came together with the help of the Kurds and formed a government that met the interests of the largest possible swath of the Iraqi public. It took 7 months, and it certainly could have happened a lot faster, but it was an Iraqi decision to come to this coalition-type government. It is a sign that the Iraqis are making the political decisions that make sense in our view and in their view to deal with a culture and society that has faced many historical, traditional, deep divisions, has faced the issue of Saddam Hussein's rule, has faced isolation from both the business community, but also the political and diplomatic community over certainly the last part of Saddam Hussein's regime. What does this partnership mean? I mentioned the Strategic Framework Agreement, and I mentioned that this is a framework that allows us a broad bilateral cooperation, a broad basis for bilateral cooperation. Despite the lack of a government until just before Christmas, we were able to work with Iraqi technocrats in all the key ministries on setting the foundation for this bilateral partnership. We're able to do that because the Iraqis are moving forward on their own development plans. Conferences to aid Iraq are not held outside of Iraq, they're held inside of Iraq. Iraq is developing its own resources and is looking for technical assistance as it goes forward in rebuilding Iraq in a model that I would argue, and I defer to my Iraqi colleagues on this, but that returns to Iraq in the 50s, when Iraq was the leader in the region for healthcare, for agriculture, for culture, for arts. And people look back at that past, and they're trying to rebuild this. And this is going to be a complicated mission, but it's something that we are partnering with the Iraqis to do. Now, this is going to be done in a regional context. This is going to be done where there are domestic issues and then there are outside forces. So let me start with the domestic issues and where we see the advantages and the possibilities and the challenges, and then I'll switch to the regional and international. Domestically, this is the first country in the Middle East where all decisions are not made in the capital. We have the provinces, and there were elections in January of 2009 for provincial councils and governors. There were the open list system was used for those elections, and people actually elected local representatives who have some budget responsibility. Now, the Provincial Powers Act, which helps set up that decentralization, has not been fully implemented yet. That's one of our priorities, is to see that implemented. Municipal elections were not held, so we're beginning on this path. But the first thing that we see in working domestically in Iraq is that there is something we don't see in some other parts of the world, is decisions don't have to be made in the capital. The local people can have some say on what these decisions are. And that's extremely important when you look at a country that has so many different ethnic, multi-confessional areas, and where there are issues that relate to local people's interests and concerns. There will be always a trend towards pulling decisions back to the center. But economically, in terms of security, in terms of projects, we're pushing to work with those provinces and their provincial governors and the provincial councils, some of which are working better than others, to push this model of decentralization. Civil society. I've spent my career in the Middle East looking at how civil society can develop, where people can choose issues and topics to solidify around, make their voices heard, and not be under the thumb of repressive controls. Now, we're in a situation in Iraq where the civil society law, the non-governmental organizations law, is one of the best that we've seen in the Middle East in terms of allowing people to organize around issues. This is still in a nascent stage. There's many NGOs in Iraq who are just one person and a website, or they represent a political interest, or they've been taken over by various forces. But when you think about what actually, one of the elements that helped government formation were two civil society cases, one saying that the members of parliament shouldn't be paid because they hadn't actually gone to do any work since they had been elected, and the other one saying that the Supreme Court had to make a decision on how long the government had to form. These were both initiated by civil society NGO groups. And when you think about the world and think of the possibility that these would be developed, this is extremely important. When you look at the institutions in Iraq, there's both challenges and opportunities. We have a Council of Representatives, a parliament, that has gone from 275 members to 325 members. Its role will be to balance the executive. It started to try and play that role last year. We already are seeing signs of that Council of Representatives, that parliament, seeking to balance the executive. There's a lot of work to do there. There's going to be frictions, a push and tug between the executive branch and Congress, which when you watch the State of Union of the Union tonight, you'll see some of the tug and pull between the executive branch and Congress here. But this is something that we expect will be in the long run positive. But it's in the short run, when faced with a coalition government and a Council of Representatives that's seeking to establish its authorities, this is going to be complex. In terms of the economy, just briefly, the opening up for the oil bid rounds in a free and fair manner was for us extremely significant. And the fact that the calls for just an Iraqi national company to develop Iraq's patrimony changed to an international business model that went to a lot of different companies is extremely important. We think this is the tip of the iceberg, which is, or the point of the sword, to bring other foreign investors into Iraq to do the essential investment in Iraq's infrastructure that's so important to Iraq's future. The problems that we face domestically. The Arab Kurd issue is by far everyone knows the significance of this, and I can get into the question and answer period about where we see the Arab Kurd conflict. I will say that President Barzani's influence in the negotiations between Ayad Alawi's Iraqiya and Prime Minister Maliki's state of law was significant. What we see, as the Vice President likes to see, is the politics of compromise. We see people working together on what's your interest and what's my interest and how do we move forward on this. We believe that you will see in the coming weeks movement on hydrocarbons between the Kurdish region in the north and the central government in Baghdad. You will see discussions of how to work on the disputed internal boundaries. This is very important for both sides. It is also a critical issue that can cause instability in Iraq. And that's why our two embassy branch offices that were, besides the consulates, will be in Mosul and Kirkuk, which are on the Arab-Kurd fault line. Corruption. If there's anything that can cause an enormous instability in Iraq, particularly as the oil revenues increase and come in, it's going to be corruption. And here we see that Council of Representatives can be a force, as we saw last year, going after ministers. We see that the free media, that the press that can write about the type of corruption, whether it's government ministers, whether it's connected people, is extremely important. There's been efforts to control the media, and certainly violence and intimidation exist, but a free media is one of the important legs of a method of dealing with corruption. Finally, the judiciary. We've put a lot of effort. I work very closely with the Department of Justice on their programs with the Iraqi judiciary. We've protected judges. We've helped train judges. We will continue to work with what we think is an extremely important leg, which is an independent judiciary. But at the end of the day, the ones that have to take the lead on combating corruption will be the executive branch. And we think that because of the elections, because of the focus of popular discontent on corruption, this will be something that will be addressed by the government. But this is not going to be solved easily or quickly, and it's going to be an issue that we have to face. Much more I can talk about the domestic side, but let me switch to the regional side quickly, and then so we can get to questions and answers. On the regional side and on the international side, this is an issue of bringing a government in a country that under Saddam Hussein had been isolated economically, politically, in every way from its neighbors and from the international community, especially with the sanctions at the end and so many of the relations between Iraq and its neighbors were broken. What we see now is an Iraqi government that wants to balance its relations. There's a Turkish role, a very strong Turkish role, which I can talk about. There's an Iranian role. There's a Syrian role. There's a Jordanian role. There's a Kuwaiti role. There's a Saudi role. There's a wider Middle East role, Egypt, the rest of the Gulf. These are all countries that are going to have, that are looking very carefully at what's happening in Iraq and are looking to see how Iraq will reintegrate into the region. And for us, this has to be a priority, because how Iraq reintegrates with the region will determine that investment that I talked about. The best type of investment would be direct investment from close in, from the Gulf, where they have the ability to invest. And we're seeing signs of progress. The recent visit of the Kuwaiti prime minister to Iraq was extremely significant. And that will be one of the ultimate tests, because, of course, the invasion of Kuwait was a dramatic upheaval in the Middle East, and Kuwait is very, very nervous about what is going on in Iraq and is watching the situation very carefully. So progress on Iraq-Kuwait issues will send a message to the rest of the region. Turkey was had a role to play in everything that goes on in Iraq, whether economically and politically, but had a role to play in the government formation that occurred. And Turkey has enormous interests and relations with the government of Iraq. And I would just point out the relations with the independent Kurdish region that I see in from Turkey to that region and the central government has changed 180 degrees from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, it was an invasion, or 2.5 years ago, it was an invasion of Turkish land forces into northern Iraq. Now you have Talabani and Barzani visiting Turkey. You have Turkish consulates. You have Turkish involvement. The economic importance of Turkey, of Turkey getting the natural gas and hydrocarbons, Iraq getting good quality Turkish goods rather than poorer quality goods from other places, is extremely important. The big question, of course, is Iran. And our argument there is that the Iranians will always have influence in Iraq, but they've chosen to use soft power for the most part because they've failed at using the hard power, whether it's the Jaish al-Mahdi, whether it's the terrorist groups that we see evidence that they continue to supply. These have not succeeded in making an impression on the Iraqi people that's favorable. And we saw that in the January provincial elections that I talked about, where provincial candidates that had sided with Iran were not successful. Iran has definitely tried to make its mark felt, largely in rejecting things that either we or the Iraqi open political system have supported. Iran opposed the open list system that allows people to vote for individual candidates rather than parties. Iran tried to coordinate all the Shia together in the Iraqi National Alliance and failed at that. Iran has tried to cancel the security agreement that was approved by the Council of Representatives in 2008. Iran has, on a number of fronts, sought to exert its influence and has failed. It will continue to influence events in Iraq, as the Turks do, and as I would argue the Jordanians and Syrians will, and it will play an important role. But we see that the holy places of Qom in Iran versus Najaf and Karbala, there's a dynamic there that those of you in this room understand, but I often have to explain to people that Iranian Shiism and Iraqi Shiism are very different. And when we talk about Iranian influence in Iraq, there are natural barriers to this. The Iraq-Iran war, 6 years, a million casualties, is something that is still ever present in people's minds. I think this is a complex subject, and we can discuss it some more in the question and answers period, but I just think it's important to note that there is a balance in Iraq to Iranian influence. Nobody is working directly for Iran. Everyone in Iraq is now trying to rebuild the country itself, and we can get to that in the question and answer period. Just moving to the international period and the region, on December 15th, the Vice President went to New York for a very important event for Iraqis, which was to lift some of the Chapter 7 resolutions that have been on Iraq going back to 1990 in some cases, and that was weapons of mass destruction. More recently, it was the Development Fund for Iraq. These are issues that are helping to bring Iraq back into the international community, showing that it is a partner both internationally and regionally as we go forward. And I think it's important to underline that Iraq's relations, its desire to, for example, signing up for the non-proliferation standards with the IAEA, these are efforts by the Iraqi government to show that it is ready to join the international community and international regimes as fast as possible, and they're working to develop those. I think I've spent 15 minutes, and I really want to get to questions and answers. So at this point, and I haven't talked about whole areas, human rights, some more issues on trade and politics, but I really would like to have a discussion and give you as much information as I can. So I'll defer to Marina.
My plan had been to ask the first question. I can see hands going up all over the place. I think I'll pass it for the time being. David Mack, the gentleman here.
Those of us who've
please wait for the microphone, and the Mr. Mack will start. Go ahead.
David Mack from the Middle East Institute. Thank you so much for managing to sound positive and confident without declaring victory. It's kind of refreshing to see somebody in such a moderate mode on this issue and not falling into either despair or triumphalism. You mentioned very quickly the development of their oil sector. Does the administration no longer believe that it's absolutely necessary that they have a new petroleum law in order to make some kind of progress in developing the oil and gas industries in Iraq?
That absolutely, we believe a hydrocarbons law is essential for many reasons, including the fair and equitable distribution of petroleum resources. And this is one of our top priorities. And as I said, we've already seen very encouraging signs between the Kurdistan region and the central government to discuss the first issue on that agenda, which is Kurdish reserves found in Kurdistan and deals that were signed between the Kurdish government and particularly Turkey, but other countries. We believe that this is something that is a priority for the government. And if there is the progress that we think there is in Kurdish central government relations on this issue, it opens the door for addressing the other issue. So the hydrocarbons law is very important. As I said, this new 325-member Council of Representatives is going to have to tackle a lot of issues, but this is one that we will continue to work with them on.
And can you all please identify yourselves when you...
I'm Landon Bolling. We've been accustomed to hearing so much bad news about the Middle East. It's good to hear some encouraging good news. But I want to ask about the continuing bad news about the refugees who have left. Anyone who's been in Jordan recently knows that they've got more than 1 million people there, most of whom think they'll never go home. Bad as Hussein was, and he was a terrible man, there was a degree of tolerance in regard to religion and regard to the status of women under Hussein that does not exist in much of the Middle East even now. So in this partnership that you speak about, are we going to have influence about their dealing with the Christian minority who have largely fled?
Certainly. And let me start with the wider issue of refugees and internally displaced persons, because this is an enormous challenge in Iraq and in the neighboring countries. And I was chargé d'affaires in Syria for 2 years, and one of the primary areas I worked on was working with the Syrian government, who we did not have good relationships with at that time, last 2 years of the Bush administration, on helping the Iraqi refugees in Syria. I think that, and I'm speaking from, because it's still early to tell, but our initial indications are those people who were waiting to see the results of this government formation period in particularly Syria and Jordan are, how should I say this, they are cautiously optimistic about the fact that the Sunnis are included. Major Sunni figures are there. Iraqiya was able to play a large role in the formation of the government. Those people, and if you remember just a little bit of history, that the Sunnis were held up the election law at one point because the refugees weren't, their votes weren't going to be counted in Syria and Jordan and other countries. So this is very important to refugees, and I think that if the conditions in Iraq continue to go the way we see the security trends and the economic trends, we'll see some more of those people return who were waiting to see what type of government will form in Iraq. This is, refugees make their own decisions about when they'll go back. But going to specific, and the largest, whenever I'm asked about a problem or challenge, my goal is to say, where's the Iraqi partner to make sure that the conditions are going to be met? Because if it's just us, it's not going to happen. The Iraqi partner are particularly those Sunnis who make up a large part of the internally displaced population who are going to follow this issue very, very closely. So I think that from a government-wide, an Iraqi government point of view, there are partners to work on it. Specifically on the minorities issue, and it's not just Christian minorities, it's Yazidis, it's Shabak. Terrorists are targeting these individuals because they're defenseless, because it sends a signal that the government can't protect them. It's a heinous and criminal activity by the terrorists, but we are very encouraged since the October 31st attack on the site at Zainab Church in Baghdad, that the government, political leadership, the security forces have taken new steps to address the needs of those minority communities in Iraq. And I think this is extremely important, and we think we have partners in the Iraqi government who will address this issue, that to not allow the terrorists to make points on attacking these vulnerable individuals. It's very important that we continue to focus on this, but I will note this is a problem for minorities, particularly Christian minorities throughout the Middle East. And I worked in Syria for 2 years, which had a Saddam Hussein like system in some ways, but Syrian Christians are leaving Syria for economic reasons, for civil society reasons, for participation reasons, and they're not leaving for security reasons. So we need to take a more global approach to the issue of minorities throughout the Middle East, the Copts in Egypt being another example.
I will take three questions this time because I can see all the hands are going up. Samuels, and then you and the gentleman behind you.
Mr. Corbett, Sam Wells from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Could you, as you look at the tea leaves of this newly forming government, give an indication of what you expect for the role of Dr. Iyad Alawi and for the not yet fully formed Security Council?
The gentleman there.
Alan Kieswetter, CNL Resources. Thank you for the fine report, Michael. I wonder if you could say a few words, please, about post-2011 U.S. troop levels. It's hard to see how there can be adequate exterior defense or external defense without some troops staying behind. And what is sort of the planning assumption from the Department of State's point of view?
Yeah. I'm Frank Oliveri from Congressional Quarterly. Just a question. There's been some talk from the Republican caucus on the Hill about cutting back funding for USAID significantly and other areas for State Department as they try to, reduce deficit spending. I would hope you would address a little bit what kind of impact that might have on our future plans in Iraq.
Thank you. Starting with the question on Dr. Alawi, which I could speak for 15 minutes on, but the importance is that The National Council for Higher Policies, which is a new creation and is specifically designed to balance some of the security decisions that were being made only in the executive or only in one part of the executive branch, are now going to be made by this committee. This was an important part of the deal that brought about the coalition government. Dr. Alawi has agreed to serve as the head of this, the National Council. This is it's complicated because it's a new creation, and there's still negotiations going on about this, although the agreement is pretty much set. There will be unhappiness on everyone's side, and I can predict if I was to come back in 6 months and talk to you again, there would still be discussions on the role of this National Council for Higher Policy. The important thing is that compromise was the watchword, and Prime Minister Maliki has agreed to compromise on some of the security organs that he thought were important to be under executive control. There's a complicated formula worked out for how this National Council on Higher Policies will operate, and it will be formed soon. It's going to the Council of Representatives. It's going to be voted on. It will be established, I predict, but there will be a lot more discussion on it before it gets formed and once it gets formed, because it's a new creation and it will have an important role to play. Moving on to the second question, post-2011 U.S. troop presence, the important point is that we are committed to the security agreement, which calls for the withdrawal of U.S. forces by the end of this year. Just as we kept the first, or it wasn't the first, it was a, but it was an important condition of the security agreement, which was to go down to 50,000 troops last year. We did that, and we will continue to work according to the security agreement, which is our agreement with the government of Iraq. What we are doing, though, is setting up an Office of Security Cooperation, as we have in many countries around the world, and building a military partnership built on training and assistance and working with the Iraqi military in a wide range of areas. And this is part of our planning and part of the Department of Defense's planning as we go forward to have that presence in Iraq, as we do in Egypt and we do in Turkey and we do in other countries around the Middle East and around the world. In terms of our planning assumptions at the State Department, this is a military to civilian transition. We are transitioning from being dependent on the military for many of our movements and our security to doing it ourselves. And this is extremely important. And there's a big test for the State Department as to whether we can do this, whether our diplomatic security, which has a different approach than the military's force protection, can protect our personnel, whether we can do our movements, whether we can operate without the large U.S. military security blanket we have there. We think we can. We're moving out on a plan. We've done this in other countries. It is hard and it is expensive, and I'll get to that in a minute in the last question. But the Iraqis will look and see what type of relationship they want. They want a security relationship. They've already bought American equipment. They will want to ask for certain things, perhaps, but at this point, we're working on the basis of the security agreement we have and on the basis of an Office of Security Cooperation, which for State Department people, it's very important to note, is under Chief of Mission Authority. In other words, it's under the ambassador, and it's something that is one of the tools of a broad bilateral partnership. On the last question, which is extremely important, and I spend a lot of time talking to members and staff on the Hill, This how we do this military to civilian transition is vital for us in a number of ways. It's about our credibility in the region. It's about, as Secretary of Defense Gates says, not reliving the last chapter of Charlie Wilson's war. It's about giving the State Department the resources to take over, to allow our troops to come home, to build a partnership with the Iraqis in a country where it is extremely expensive, where we have to do our own logistics, where we're going to have to rely on contractors for a lot of the services, where we're going to have to use our own helicopters and internal fixed-wing aircraft to get around because the domestic carriers and so on are not developed enough. This is extremely important to us. And I go and talk to members of Congress all the time. We got support. Some people mistakenly said that members of Congress didn't support the project to build the two consulates and the two embassy branch offices. So they did. The one nuance they had is that these wouldn't be permanent construction yet. These would be temporary construction because there's a process for permanent construction. They wanted to go through that process. We believe that there is support for the fact that Iraq is able to stand on its two feet. It will have oil resources that will pay for its own development. This is not an open-ended commitment, but it's very important that as we transition to the Iraqis being fully in charge and fully running their program, that we continue to provide the technical assistance that helps them spend their own resources. And this is going to be expensive. And for as a member of the State Department going and arguing for resources that are tiny for Department of Defense, this is huge for the State Department, and our appropriators are different than the defense appropriators, and we need to give the best possible case as to why this is an important partnership. And we think that our Iraqi partners are giving perhaps the best possible argument for this as we go forward and face the challenges that we have ahead.
Okay, I have Barbara Slavin, the gentleman here, and then back there.
Hi, Barbara Slavin, the Atlantic Council. Mr. Corbyn, forgive me, I came in late. If you talked about Muqtada Sadr, I don't want to make you repeat, but I'd like your evaluation of his role. Is he a potential Hassan Nasrallah? What is his connection with Iran? You seem to very blithely dismiss Iran's influence in the country, but many suggest it will be much greater than that. And if you could also talk about the situation with the MEK folks in Camp Ashraf. What is the United States doing to protect them, to find them permanent homes? Thanks.
Okay. On your other
side. Hi, I'm Wallace Hayes, an independent consultant. I'd like to ask you about the Sunni perspective of the elections and Iraqiya. And one can make a case that Iraqiya and the Sunnis arguably don't have much more in the new government than they had in the previous government. They held the speakership, they held the defense ministry, they do now hold the finance ministry. But the speakership of parliament is not, with all due respect, analogous to the United States. It doesn't have a secretariat, as you know. And one can look at the results and say, Iraqiya won the most seats. They were the only party in Iraq that won seats in all three regions of the country, winning over 13% of their seats in southern Iraq. And they were the only major party that had a significant cross-sectarian group voting for them. Yet, in some ways, it seems like they got little more than what they got after the election that they boycotted in the first round. So I'd like you to respond to that. Thanks.
And one more over there.
My name is Bill Broidrick, and I have a technical question. If you read the SOFA, it looks like it actually expires in November, and obviously the troops go out at the end of the year. And the second is, reflecting of the earlier question, when will a defense minister and an interior minister be appointed in Iraq? Because right now, obviously, the prime minister is holding both portfolios.
Great. Starting off with Muqtada al-Sadr, which I didn't talk about, so I'm happy to get the question. The Sadrists achieved 39 seats in the new Council of Representatives, which showed a certain electoral strength. And certainly they wanted to play a significant role, as all the parties and coalitions did in the new government. We would argue that they perhaps haven't played the significant role in the new government that they wanted to play. I would say that Muqtada al-Sadr's sudden, and it was unannounced, return to Iraq was not on a wave of triumphalism or on a wave of the Sadrists had thrown their weight around in Iraq. It was a quiet return to Najaf, where he sought to reestablish his bona fides. He didn't speak on the Friday prayer day. He spoke on Saturday, the day after prayer day. He's now returned to Iran, as far as we know. We'd say that his presence and his return to Iraq raises all sorts of questions. I mean, to Iraq, yeah. He's not in Iraq now. He has returned to Iran. We don't know whether he's coming back to Iraq very quickly. We don't know whether he's going on a trip to other countries. But what we will say is that it raises lots of complex questions about what Sadr's relationship is with Iran, what his political future is, whether he's going to pursue the religious track that he was talking about. He certainly and his followers will have influence, but I would argue that there's nothing to say that he has anything like the influence of Nasrallah in Lebanon. I would say that his relationship with Iran is extremely unclear. And I'd say that this is one of those questions that we will deal with. The Sadrists are part of the government. It's just that they're not perhaps the part of the government they wanted to be when everyone was negotiating and jostling for control. On the Camp Ashraf residents, which are from the former Mojahedin-e Khalq organization, when I was in Iraq for almost a year, spent a lot of time working with them to explain to the residents of Camp Ashraf that when the Chapter 7 mandate came to an end and the security agreement went into force, they were, and they already had not been under our protection, they were solely under the responsibility of sovereign Iraq. We beseeched them, we worked with them to negotiate a different status in Iraq. They claim that because Saddam Hussein gave them title to this town of Ashraf, because he armed them, because they have a status there, that they should be allowed to stay in Iraq. Unfortunately, they have Iranian passports. Saddam Hussein was very clever. He didn't give them any title to any land in Iraq. They voluntarily gave up their weapons. They are a group that needs to determine its future status, and it's up to the Iraqi government to determine how to deal with them. Now, the history of the Mujahideen-e Khalq is a very, and from our point of view, and they're designated us as a foreign terrorism organization because they've been responsible for the deaths of U.S. citizens and U.S. service people in Iran. They were part of the group that took over the U.S. embassy, which we're celebrating the anniversary of the release of hostages this week. They've played a role in terrorism. The group now says that they have given up terrorism and that they are a peaceful group. We don't believe that that's true. We believe that we focus from an Iraq point of view on the status of this group in Iraq and how they are going to regularize their status with the Iraqi government. I'd note that they refuse to take refugee status. They say that they're not refugees and they're not. Some of them have returned to Iran, and some of them have returned to Iran under good conditions. Some of them have returned to Iran and have suffered enormous repression. We've worked with the government of Iraq to get assurances that that group that's there is not going to be, which the technical term is refouled, or there won't be refoulement to a country where they will be repressed. But this is an issue that is constantly in the media, constantly gets attention. It's a very difficult one, but this is as if boat people had arrived on the shores of the northern shores of the Mediterranean. What is their status with the governments that are responsible for the security of those countries? That's got to be worked out. The next question was on Sunni participation in the new government. Very good question. I would say that the Sunni participation is quantitatively and qualitatively different than in the last government. When you look at Assam al-Najafi, whose brother is the governor of Nineveh, when you look that he was the first person named in this government and that he has stood up very dramatically for Sunni positions. When you look at the fact that the Sunnis boycotted the first election, they participated in the second elections in 2005 and the government that was formed in 2006. Their actual weight in this government and their organization that they have put to participate in these elections represents a different type of Sunni participation. We'll have to see how this develops. I'm optimistic, and people have noted that I'm giving an optimistic view of this, and there are many pitfalls ahead. But the Sunnis have decided to participate in this government. Rafi al-Issaoui, who was a technocrat when I knew him and worked with him, over the summer during government formation was a very strong Sunni nationalist, is now the Minister of Finance. That is a key position in this government. That's controlling the purse strings. I'd say that the Sunnis are going to look at that a little bit differently. We haven't, and it gets to the last question about the Minister of Defense. It's not a question of whether it will be a Sunni Minister of Defense. It's a question of which Sunni it will be. And I think that this is important because the person that Prime Minister Maliki would like is Abdul Qadir, who was the al-Mufriji, who was the former Minister of Defense, who's a Sunni, but the Sunnis have made clear that that's not acceptable to them. This is under discussion. I would note that the Minister of Defense and the Minister of Interior were the last people chosen in 2006 when the government was formed, so we don't see an issue there in terms of where we... Well, there's always the potential for issues, and there will be unhappiness on many people's part, but the major Sunni political players have roles in this government. Saleh al-Mutlaq, who is certainly in no way a non-controversial figure, is playing a role. This is extremely important. The last question on the technicality of the security agreement, and I did not bring my copy that I have pasted to my wall, but I would be, I think there's... I don't know exactly what you're referring to technically, but I'm sure that the agreement finally goes out of force December 31st. So,
is it going to be renegotiated? Is it going to be a subsequent?
Well, that is something that the Iraqis will have to come and ask us for, and that's something that refers to the earlier question, well, about what is our planning assumption, and as the State Department, we have to plan, as we have done, to maintain the terms of that agreement.
Thank you. There is a question back there and one on the other side.
Henry Hetker, research at NARA. You've indicated all these different approaches by the new Iraqi government in handling relations with all its neighbors. And I wondered how its neighbors, especially on the other side of the Gulf, look at the new Iraq. Are they quite pleased with the results, or do they look at it as a potential threat? They're clearly concerned about Iran. But what are their feelings on Iraq? And is there any agreements between Iraq and Iran that might threaten the nations, the smaller nations on the other side of the Gulf?
Asil Barghouti, I'm at the Middle East program here at Carnegie. There have been mutterings as of late that Prime Minister Maliki is actually moving towards centralizing power. And in the context of what you said about decentralization being the most effective form of power sharing between groups, what are the implications of this move on relations between the various sects in Iraq?
First, on the first question, on the view of the neighbors, I really have to defer to, and I would say, to look at their media and look at their statements on what their views are on Iraq. From the U.S. perspective, I pointed to the visit by the Kuwaiti prime minister, which is the small country which is probably greatest, feels the greatest threat from Iraq, as a positive sign. I think that when Iraq was descending into civil war and was a source of incredible violence, or had incredible violence and was a potential source of violence, and foreign fighters going into Iraq, getting trained, if they didn't become suicide bombers, perhaps going back out into the Middle East, as we saw after the Afghan experience. I think this was a greater threat to the rest of the region than we see now, in terms of a country that's doing everything possible to send the signal that it wants to establish good relations. The fact that the Arab League has decided that the summit, the annual summit, should take place in March in Iraq, and I'm not saying it necessarily is going to take place there, but it's the intention of the Arab League to do that. The invitation has been issued. The Emir of Kuwait said he'd go. Different Arab leaders have said they're going to attend that summit in Baghdad. That would be an extremely important signal that would show the Arab League supporting Iraq's reintegration into the region. I think Iraq has always been a military power, and it's famous for its military status in the Middle East. I think people in the Gulf would be concerned to see how the Iraqi military develops and what the Iraqis plan to do with their military and how they plan to develop. And I think people will be watching that. But I think given what we've seen in the agreements that the Iraqis want to sign, the Iraqis are seeking to gain direct foreign investment. And Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, countries in the Gulf are a great source for that. And I think that there's already signs of on housing projects and others that the Iraqis are working for better relations. Whether there's agreements with Iran, lots of agreements are always announced between countries. I'd say there's nothing threatening about and I would put them in the category of soft power agreements that the Iranians have signed with the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government has signed numerous agreements with the Turkish government, despite a diplomatic or deeper problem with Syria. The recent visit of Maliki to Damascus led to a bunch of agreements being signed. So I see the Iraqis working to be reintegrated into the region, and I absolutely believe that the region will put a magnifying glass on Iraq as it goes forward to see how it develops, to see what happens there. And so I think that's very important. In terms of centralizing, I think I would just step back and maybe take a different view of centralizing. Wherever you are in the world, it's easier to make decisions if you are the only one who has to make them. And it's easier if you have a small circle that has to make them. And it's still easy if you just make them in the capital. This is a natural trend and we've seen it, it doesn't matter what the political system is. There is always going to be a tend to centralizing power. And that's why systems of checks and balance are developed. I'd say that Maliki and others who, in order to address electricity problems, made decisions that perhaps a prime minister should make in consultation with others. It was the security decisions he made that he came under the most criticism for. And that's where you have the balance between a leader who can make effective decisions and one who makes effective decisions that people don't like. We're going to work to support decentralization because we believe that if the people in a region believe that their representatives have a say, that they are going to be happier in the decisions that are made. And we will continue to push for this. We see the ultimate case of a region is the independent Kurdish region in the north and its relations with Baghdad. And as the independent Kurdish region and its government sees its future in Baghdad, and certainly Barzani traveling down to Baghdad to help negotiate the agreement that led to this government formation, we see that as a sign of that region seeing its future in the capital, which is sort of the opposite of decentralization. But as this affects the groups, the Basra, we're going to have a consulate in Basra. Basra was seeking to break away and maybe form an autonomous region. There's some murmurings about that again, but it's an important part of the economic whole of Iraq, and we see that that this decentralization is extremely important as we go forward.
Okay, I have Scott Carpenter here, the gentleman there, and then I think I'll piggyback my question.
Certainly.
thank you, Marina, and thank you, Michael. I guess just a quick comment and then a question. It's always bothered me when I talk to U.S. military units, especially out in Iraq who are going to Iraq, when they always say to their Iraqi counterparts, we're leaving, but the State Department is replacing us. And I make the point very quickly to say to them, no, you are not being replaced by the State Department. You're being replaced by the Iraqi army. And so I think in terms of setting expectations, there's no way for the State Department to replace DOD or the billions of dollars we've spent. So I think expectations are very high still about this partnership. So I wanted to ask you about the strategic framework agreement. We've lost 7 months in a certain sense. I know the committees have been meeting. But what are, between now and December 31st, what are the things that the Iraqis are going to see and that we are going to be able to convey to them where this partnership has actually borne fruit? Because I think it's extremely important that it do so.
Great. No, thank you for the question. And I would, or the comment, it's It's even more, of course, that the best situation is that the Iraqis are taking over, and I think that's the overwhelming theme of my talk, if there is a theme, is that the Iraqis are a partner, the Iraqis are making decisions, and the Iraqis are taking over in Iraq. But I would go a little bit more into a little bit more detail. What the State Department is doing is completely different from what the military does. And I have the same discussion with my military colleagues about our, for example, our police development program, which I didn't get a chance to talk to, replaces a military police training program that's been going on for 5 or 6 years. Our program is very different because instead of getting, and I'm simplifying, but instead of getting recruits trained and on the streets with AK-47s, we're going to be doing a program that works on community policing, on human resources control, on training and management, and how you build a police force that doesn't just face a counterterrorism threat, but actually works against organized crime, which is a huge problem in Iraq, works against drugs, which works with the communities. When we talked about the minority communities before, how do you protect a community that's vulnerable but and is different from the other people? So our programs are going to be very different from the military programs, even though some of the same people from our International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Bureau who have been working on the military program will work on our program. But we're not replacing the U.S. military. We're doing what the Iraqis want, which gets to the second part of your question, which is to build a broad partnership that shows not just security cooperation, but more effective cooperation in the areas of education, in agriculture, and in other areas where the Iraqis have are placing a priority. And this is where our technical expertise can make a difference. I think we have an enormous public diplomacy challenge to get to the where's the beef question, because many of these agreements are agreements at a technical level and actually make enormous differences to the network or the electrical grid. But how do you explain to the Iraqi people that there's something here that makes a difference for Iraq? I just would point to something that we sometimes minimize, but some of the things that make a difference are would be surprising. The December 15th UN session on Iraq, which was, the vice president went, so it was covered here, but it was minor news here. In Iraq, it was huge because this was a sign that Iraq was being welcomed back into the international community. And our effort to remove Chapter 7 sanctions is part of that strategic framework agreement. And that had enormous significance as we went forward. There's going to be other areas that education. We haven't had a very good partnership in education because of bureaucratic and other and political problems. We see education and the thirst for education among and dealing with an almost lost generation as extremely important, and we need to work with the Iraqi Education Ministry in lots of areas where they are seeking help. I think the NGO law, the fact that the Iraqis have come up with a model NGO law that we need to help them implement. This, for me, is where you really get popular participation in organizations that can address people's needs. And in Egypt, we saw it on Scott. You may know that. Remember the parents who were objecting to tutors who were or the teachers who were demanding that the kids had were tutored by the teachers, on the fact that the Ministry of Education in Egypt had enormous problems. These are civil issues that have enormous resonance among the people of these societies. And for me, I'm encouraged by the ability of or the opportunity for civil society organizations to function in Iraq. And that's one of the things that we're going to work very hard on. We've had an AID program there for a long time. It's going to be different than the military protected program, because now we have a chance to do development in partnership with the Iraqis and according to their priorities. And this is going to be something that I think is going to be welcome. But I will acknowledge absolutely that the where's the beef, and that happens in the United States a lot. It's where do you show the advances that directly impact on the people as we go forward? And that's where we're aided by the fact that Iraq has resources. It's not a question of continuing using U.S. resources. It's a question of helping the Iraqis use their own resources in the most wise way. We can do a lot by coordinating with the EU and other donors like the South Koreans and others, Japanese, who have given money to Iraq but now want to coordinate those efforts. And the Iraqis are working on not having everyone support the same type of projects, but coordinate in Baghdad together on making those projects more effective.
Okay, there was a question. Wahid Al-Samarai, representative of Al-Iraqiya and Dr. Allawi in Washington, D.C. My question is, Last few days, there is a lot of explosion happening in Iraq, and close to 1,000 of people, they was killed there. And my question is that the reason for the missing of the security ministries or the withdrawing of the U.S. troops? And the American government said yesterday or before yesterday, we are continuous still withdrawing our troops from Iraq. What's your opinion about that?
Well,
Thank you.
We're extremely concerned about the continuing violence in Iraq, but when we look at what the different extremists are able to do, and right now there's a number of factors. It's the period of Arba'in when the Shia pilgrims, as you know from Iraq, are exposed because they're walking on roads, and the Iraqi security forces have done an enormous job of protecting the Arba'in pilgrims. But this is a target that's extremely difficult to protect. It's something that we work constantly with the Iraqi security forces to address. The ability, for example, of Al-Qaeda in Iraq to launch simultaneous large-scale attacks around the country has all but disappeared. They are not able to launch the type of attacks that they were able to launch before. They're still incredibly awful attacks, and they're still conducting attacks, but we see the Iraqi security forces have made enormous steps in control. After all, we've been out of the cities since June of 2009, per the security agreement. We've been working on every element to help the Iraqi security forces to address this. As far as I know, and I'm always willing to be told differently, there's no connection at all between the security situation right now and the fact that the negotiations still continue about the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior. So this is something, and when you talk about the troop withdrawal, I mentioned the Office of Security Cooperation. We will continue to work with the Iraqi security forces on helping them to be the professional force that they are turning into and have turned into to deal with whatever threat that they face. And we have long relations with Egypt. We have relations with Jordan. We have relations with Turkey where we have, and each relationship is different, but we see military cooperation, and it's in the Strategic Framework Agreement. Military cooperation will continue to be a part of our cooperation with Iraq into the future.
Let me just. Oh, I can't resist the pushing this. You have been playing down the role that Iran is playing in the country, and essentially you pointed out to the fact that at this point it's mostly soft power rather than the hard power that we saw in the past. You could argue to some extent that the same thing is true for the United States, that the United States, as the State Department takes over from the military, that it's going to move towards a situation where it's soft power that counts rather than hard power. So are we facing a battle, essentially, between a competition between the soft power of Iran and the soft power of the United States?
Soft power is what diplomacy is really about. What I would argue that U.S. soft power comes with technical assistance, comes with real economic agreements, comes when you look at the agreements that Iran has signed around the region, Syria being one example, and you see what the actual effects and the actual tangible status of those projects and agreements are, you often find that there's not much there. So we think that if it comes to a competition between Iranian soft power and U.S. soft power, we have an enormous advantage. And it's not about us, again. I always said that it's about the Iraqi partner. Iraqis do not want lower quality goods from Iran when they can have higher quality goods from Turkey. Iraqis don't want the second or third grade of vegetables and fruits from Iran when they can have better quality vegetables and fruits grown in their own country. I think that the Iraqis will make the determination of their relations. The Iraqis are going to be balancing Turkey, the Arab Gulf, Syria and Jordan, and as you know, the relations between those countries and Iraq have not always been positive. There's going to be much balancing going on, but we think that everyone is using soft power, that's a situation that the Iraqis can then determine who brings to what to their economic development, who brings what to help Iraq return to be a powerful, moderate force in the region. And we see that that's what the Iraqis are seeking to achieve, and we believe we can work with them for that goal.
Thank you. I think at this point we should let you go. No. You have been very kind.
thank you very much for this opportunity. And it really is more complex and more interesting than anyone believes. And there's a lot more work to be done in Iraq. So thank you.